Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the battle shaping up over Trump's selection for the Supreme Court to replace retiring Justice Kennedy to be announced on July the 9th. Paul Schiff Berman, a professor at George Washington University School of Law, joins us to discuss his article at the New York Times, A Better Reason to Delay Kennedy's Replacement, and how expecting Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to be shamed into adhering to the precedent he established with Merrick Garland by not allowing a Supreme Court replacement in an election year is a futile argument. Whereas not permitting President Trump to appoint a new Supreme Court justice until after the special counsel investigation into him and his campaign is over is an essential stand to take if the Supreme Court in the Trump era is to be an effective bulwark against autocratic lawless rule. With Senator Susan Collins calling for Trump to put forth a nominee who will not overturn precedent, as in Roe v. Wade, the chances of the Roberts Court, which broke precedent with Citizens United, do not look good. So we will assess what can be done to make sure a president under investigation will not be able to choose judges who will decide whether he can be indicted, can be compelled to testify before a grand jury, or can pardon himself. Then we'll speak with Mark Perry, an author and historian who specializes in military, foreign affairs, and intelligence analysis. He joins us to discuss his article at Foreign Policy, Mattis's Last Stand in Iran, and examine the growing distance between Trump and the only senior advisor left in the White House who is able to speak truth to power as Trump surrounds himself with sycophants and yes men. Along with General Mattis's behind-the-scenes efforts to prevent Trump from blundering into a war with Iran, we will also look into what Trump is likely to do at the upcoming NATO summit, where there are concerns that he will be even more boorish and disruptive than he was at the G7, and could unilaterally decide to limit the US's key role in NATO, undermining the alliance before his summit meeting with Vladimir Putin in Helsinki on July the 16th. Then, finally, we'll go to Mexico and speak with Laura Carlson, the director of the Mexico-based Americas Program at the Center for International Policy. She is currently with a group of international election monitors visiting polling places in today's watershed elections in Mexico, from which the leftist candidate, Manuel López Obrador, is likely to emerge as Mexico's next president. We will discuss what is happening on the ground today, given the outrageous number of candidates killed in a spree of violence that has marred this election so far, and whether the front-runner, who is propelled by the Mexican electorate's disgust with unchecked violence and rampant corruption, can deliver on his promises to clean up the country. And joining us now is Paul Schiff Berman, the Walter S. Cox Professor of Law at George Washington University's Law School, who also serves on the organizing committee of the Association for the Study of Law, Culture, and the Humanities, and was co-chair of the International Law and Technology Interest Group of the American Society of International Law. He's the author of Global Legal Pluralism, A Jurisprudence of Law Beyond Borders, and he has an article at the New York Times, A Better Reason to Delay Kennedy's Replacement. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Schiff Berman.
Thanks for having me.
So, obviously, I don't think Mitch McConnell can be shamed into adhering to the precedent, in effect, that he broke by not allowing a hearing for Merrick Garland and having that nomination twist in the wind for almost a year in the last year of the Obama administration. I don't think the Democrats, by saying, well, you set that precedent, therefore you have to stick with it in terms of a replacement for Justice Kennedy. That seems like pretty weak posturing. How do you see it?
Well, I think that it's probably true that no argument is going to convince Mitch McConnell to do anything other than push through a nomination as quickly as he possibly can. The question is whether it's worth, nevertheless, making arguments about what the rule of law and adherence to our constitutional principles might require. Now, I actually have some sympathy with the Merrick Garland argument. We had a popularly elected president who appointed Garland and was denied a seat because Republicans, who actually represent fewer actual voters than the Democrats in the Senate, blocked it. And then we had a president who does not command a popular majority replace what would have been Garland's seat with Gorsuch. And so, you know, there's a tremendous illegitimacy to that. So I think that's a plausible argument. I presented a different argument in the article that I wrote that was in the New York Times yesterday.
Well, we'll certainly get to that. But my sense is that, you know, there's an expression in this country, nice guys finish last. And I don't know what can be done to sort of counter the kind of thuggish behavior that's been exhibited by Mitch McConnell and by the Republicans, who are clearly pursuing power over principle. What can be done? For example, Susan Collins is now calling for Trump to put forth a nominee to replace Justice Kennedy, who will not overturn precedent such as in Roe v. Wade. But the Robert Court has broken with precedent, particularly with Citizens United, for example. So he talked a lot about stare decisis in his confirmation, Chief Justice Roberts, but he hasn't really practiced what he preaches.
And just as important as the sort of big social issue precedents like Roe versus Wade are, you know, questions of executive power and questions of national security and how the court deals with immigration issues, how they deal with, frankly, the general administrative state and the effort by governments anywhere to create economic balance in society. I think all of those things are potentially up in the air in the what will be the new court configuration. Now you ask, what can be done about it? You know, given the power politics of the moment, I think the only thing that can be done is winning a bunch of elections going forward. And that also is complicated by, first of all, the anti-democratic nature of the way the Senate is composed and the way the Electoral College is done, because it's done by state, which gives more power to less populous states, and is complicated by the existence of extreme partisan gerrymandering and voter suppression, such that Democrats have to essentially win by 7% or more just to break even. So it's, you know, all the cards are stacked against. On the other hand, it appears that the people as a whole are moving in a more progressive direction. Certainly the I guess they call them the post-millennials, at least currently, are among the most liberal generations in the history of polling. And so it may be that just pure demographics will eventually make a difference, but the eventually is the killer, because a lot can happen between now and eventually.
Well, I wonder, though, whether how long we can continue to pretend that the court, and particularly the Supreme Court, is nonpartisan, even though it has a sort of so-called liberal, although, you know, I don't know that you can compare the current liberals to some of the liberal lines like William O. Douglas and Thurgood Marshall, but nevertheless, if we stick with that definition, the liberal versus conservative split, when so much of the recent rulings seem so partisan, and of course Citizens United that I mentioned earlier is manifestly partisan, and the author of that, of course, was Justice Kennedy, who rather naively said, oh, we'll have disclosure. Well, that never happened. And there's a sort of naive quality to him, to give him the benefit of the doubt. I had one of his law clerks on a few days ago who said that he was very idealistic. So I'm sort of substituting the word naive for idealistic. But there's nothing particularly idealistic about the fact that Kennedy's son, Justin, is Donald Trump Jr.'s best friend, and when he was at Deutsche Bank, Justin Kennedy was the point man for the Trump Organization, getting vast loans from Deutsche Bank, which are essential in real estate. And Trump had been blackballed by every bank in America, except Deutsche Bank, of course, because he'd taken so many banks down in bankruptcy. So that's pretty extraordinary, don't you think, that there was this behind-the-scenes effort, apparently, to convince Kennedy to step down now so that Trump could be able to replace him before the elections, heading off the possibility of a Democratic win in November, which would then limit Trump's options. So, to me, that's just naked partisanship.
Well, I don't really have any inside information on all of that. I mean, I think I can say that when I clerked at the U.S. Supreme Court in 1997-98, I think I could fairly say at that time that although the justices obviously had very different judicial philosophies, that by and large, in most of the cases, I didn't think that they were voting kind of pure political partisanship. As of 2000, and obviously the famous Bush versus Gore decision, I think the court lost some of the legitimacy that it had earned over decades before that, such that now people really do identify justices as Democrats or Republicans in the same way that they identify senators or congresspeople as Democrats or Republicans, and that's a real loss for the idea of the rule of law. And I see that only getting worse with the way in which the Trump administration treats, and Mitch McConnell and the Republicans in the Senate, treat law, constitutional norms, procedures as things that are only tools of power, partisan politics. That's a real problem for a democracy.
And again, I'm speaking with Paul Schiff Berman, the Walter S. Cox Professor of Law at George Washington University's Law School, who also serves on the organizing committee of the Association for the Study of Law, Culture, and the Humanities, and was co-chair of the International Law and Technology Interest Group of the American Society of International Law. He's the author of Global Legal Pluralism, A Jurisprudence of Law Beyond Borders, and he has an article at the New York Times, A Better Reason to Delay Kennedy's Replacement. So let's talk about your article, and particularly the idea that Donald Trump is appointing justices, and not only will it change the 5-4 ratio to 6-3, but if the 85-year-old Ruth Bader Ginsburg were to retire, then he would have a 7-2 split, which is just extraordinary to think about. But this is a president who was under active criminal investigation, who, according to our intelligence services, there's a possibility that he's a traitor, that somehow this peculiar relationship he has with Putin, who he is going to meet with after he meets with the at the NATO summit, where NATO leaders are concerned that Trump's going to undermine NATO just as he undermined the G7 with his boorish behavior. This is an extraordinary situation we're in. We need some answers, do we not? And we're all waiting with bated breath to see what the special prosecutor is generating there in secret. So it would seem to me that how can you have the president who is being investigated choose the judges that will sit in judgment about whether or not he can be compelled to testify before a grand jury, whether he can be indicted, or whether he can pardon himself?
So this was the argument that I made in my article. We've obviously had presidents who have been investigated at various times for various wrongdoings, but I think we've never had a situation where a president was under active criminal investigation based on his activities as president and during his campaign to be president, and who has explicitly raised constitutional questions, such as whether he can be subpoenaed by the grand jury and whether he can pardon himself or his allies, the degree to which he can interfere in independent law enforcement investigations, and so forth. And so he has a stake in who the next justice is and how the Supreme Court decides that is far more personal with regard to his own status than I think we've ever seen in the history of the country. So I think that creates a situation where it's really inappropriate for him to be able to get his choice and just have it be rubber stamped by the Senate.
Well, I think you have to add to that, though, surely, that President Trump has made it clear that he's doing everything he can to either muddy the waters or shut down the Mueller investigation. And it looks as though through his surrogates, particularly Devin Nunes, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, and these Tea Party congressmen who were grilling the Deputy Attorney General last week, Rod Rosenstein. It's pretty clear what they're up to, that the White House is directing the Tea Party. They're almost like junkyard dogs. I mean, the hypocrisy of Trey Gowdy saying, you know, get this damn thing over with, when he took 2 years and spent God knows how much of taxpayers' money into that wild goose chase known as the Benghazi inquiry that he headed up and came up with absolutely nothing. So nevertheless, hypocrisy aside, it's pretty clear what the game plan is here. They're going to force Rosenstein to do stuff that's completely unacceptable, to release incredibly critical key work product from a secret investigation, which will be suddenly, you know, once Nunes gets his hands on it, will be on Fox News within minutes. And obviously, Rosenstein is going to say, no, I can't do this. And then they're going to impeach him. And that will then give Trump the excuse to shut down the Mueller investigation. I mean, it seems to me, at least from my point of view, the writing is on the wall. So don't you have to consider that as well?
Trump has made it very clear that he considers any limitations on his own power or prerogatives to be illegitimate, and that he will undermine any of them, whether it's the courts, the media, the constitutional process, or anyone else who gets in his way. So I do think that creates a constitutional crisis unlike any other that we've faced as a country, and a threat of authoritarian rule or descending into authoritarian rule that is different from any threat that we've faced before as a country. One of the amazing things, law professors often say, and historians of the constitutional law often say, that because, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court itself doesn't have, you know, a police force that it sends out to enforce its orders, its ability to function depends on never getting too far ahead or behind the American national consensus, because at some point people won't listen to what they say. And that creates a constitutional crisis, and they try to avoid it. We are potentially entering an area, particularly if Trump moves the court tremendously to the right, farther to the right than the American populace, where we actually will get to a point, I think, where the Supreme Court's own legitimacy could come into play. And if I were Chief Justice Roberts, I would be thinking hard about that.
Well, I know it sounds hyperbolic and very partisan to suggest that our president is acting like a mafia boss, but frankly, that's how it appears, and it could even be worse than him being a mafia boss. He's a wannabe mafia boss. He spent a lot of his professional career in business hanging out with crooks and criminals, and particularly Russian mobsters who have been a source of money and also have been getting condos in all of his properties around the world, and particularly the Trump Tower in Panama City was, in fact, just completely handed over to all kinds of criminals. So the extent to which he's either mobbed up or has an affinity for gangsters, we'll know more about it, particularly from the Cohen investigation. But
I think it's irrelevant in some sense whether anyone will ever find a literal quid pro quo with Russia or with Putin. It's clear that he has pursued an agenda that could not be more beneficial to Russia if he were directly being asked to do certain things. So, the path that he is taking the country on is not in the country's best interest, but it certainly is in Russia's best interest.
But the point I want to get at is that the country doesn't appear to know that, at least what 40% of the country that is in the Fox Sinclair bubble. So when liberals say that if he does fire Mueller, there'll be a constitutional crisis, what do they mean by that? I mean, is there really, can you, a bunch of people demonstrating in the street, as what happened over the weekend over Trump's outrageous, inhumane, and immoral treatment of ripping children from their parents at the border, even that writ large, what does it do?
Well, I guess we're going to find out. The question is, if we have a situation where what is demonstrably a minority of the country, both in the Senate and in the presidency and in the House because of gerrymandering, is able to wield power over a majority of the people in a way that the majority of the people disagree with but can't do anything about, what happens in a democracy? And I think, it remains to be seen. It's not clear to me that a democracy can survive that way. I don't know whether we have, outright rebellion. I don't know if we descend into civil war. Some civil war historians see signs of that. So I'm not really qualified to say, but I think that there's a broader picture here that makes it very hard for a democratic system to function long in this kind of a setting. Now, if there's a big electoral change over the next, two or three electoral cycles, then we might see something different. But if it continues this way, I'm not sure that the country can function.
Well, just in closing, it sounds like what you're saying is that we don't have a crisis of civility versus incivility, which is what people are debating now. But what, in fact, we have is a crisis of democracy and whether or not we are to still be a democracy or whether we become a kind of plutocracy and a kleptocracy, which is what you have in Russia, for example.
Yeah, I think the civility incivility argument is completely a red herring. I think we are at a point where we have an autocratic leader who clearly would like to do away with any legal checks on his authority. And I think, as I said, that we have a minority of the populace that is attempting to wield power over a majority of the populace, and that if that goes on for long, we have a crisis of constitutional democracy.
Well, Paul Schiff-Berman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Schiff-Berman, who's the Walter S. Cox Professor of Law at George Washington University School of Law. He also serves on the organizing committee of the Association for the Study of Law, Culture, and the Humanities, and was co-chair of the International Law and Technology Interest Group of the American Society of International Law, and he's the author of Global Legal Pluralism, A Jurisprudence of Law Beyond Borders, and he has an article at the New York Times, A Better Reason to Delay Kennedy's Replacement. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the Secretary of Defense Mattis's efforts to stop a war with Iran and stop Trump from undermining NATO at the upcoming NATO summit. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mark Perry, an author and historian specializing in military, foreign affairs, and intelligence analysis. His books include Conceived in Liberty, A Fire in Zion, and most recently, Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. And he has an article at Foreign Policy, Mattis's Last Stand is Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Perry.
Good to be here.
And Mark, what's your sense of where we stand with Iran? Obviously, the recent sanctions being ramped up, a lot of apparently diplomatic pressure is being put on customers of Iran's oil to stop buying Iran's oil. And there are reports in the Israeli press in Haaretz that there are a lot of pressure from Sheldon Adelson and from John Bolton to go beyond the diplomatic pressure and economic pressure into some kind of military pressure. So your piece in Foreign Policy almost makes it seem like the General Mattis, who in many ways, according to press reports, is losing influence both with Trump and may even not be around much longer, is fighting some kind of rearguard action to stop Trump from blundering into Iran?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, there is a lot of pressure. We know for certain that the National Security Council of the White House and the National Security Advisor, John Bolton, are filled with interventionists. Bolton is clearly an interventionist. He believes in regime change in Tehran. That's not going to happen by itself. 2 years ago, he came out in a widely read article saying that the way to stop the Iran bomb is to bomb Iran. So he's on the record in favor of regime change and in favor of military intervention. That's going to be very hard to do with James Mattis as Secretary of Defense. For while Mattis does not trust Iran and has had a long-term grudge against them during his military career, I think he's very hesitant and very skeptical of any kind of intervention. So the one thing that stands between us and a war with Iran, it seems to me, at least one of the things that stands between us and a war with Iran is James Mattis.
Well, what about the idea that he's not going to last long?
Well, that's very true. I think if it were up to him, he would be Secretary of Defense for another 2 years. But he's lost his influence and his leverage in the White House. Press reports now say that Donald Trump simply doesn't listen to him. He does slow roll, that's what I call it. He slow rolls many of Trump's decisions, saying yes, sir, no question, and then goes back to the Pentagon and takes his good, sweet time in implementing them.
I believe that that's the case with the military parade that Trump has ordered, right? Isn't Mattis so slow rolling that?
Oh, he's absolutely slow rolling it. It's taking a while to get organized. They've had committee meeting. I mean, this is the way it is in the Pentagon. If the military doesn't like an order and wants to implement it, they can show their disapproval inside the executive branch by taking their good, sweet time in implementing it, and that's certainly true of the military parade. We've seen this before with various presidents. I think it's even truer now with Trump. There's a lot of foot-dragging in the military on some of Mr. Trump's ideas, and there's a growing sense of unease that Mr. Trump's national security advisor and that Trump himself is kind of an interventionist, a pound the table, let's teach them a lesson kind of president. And that's certainly not where the military is, especially when it comes to Iran.
So I also wanted to talk to you not just about your article, Mark, in Foreign Policy, Mattis's Last Stand in Iran, but also talk to you about concerns expressed by NATO chiefs that at this upcoming NATO conference in I think it's June the 9th, is it not? No, is it the 16th? Yes. 16th, I think, yeah.
July 16th.
Right. Well, that's the one. I think that's the meeting with Putin. But it's right. Just slightly before then. I suppose we can be grateful that Trump didn't meet with Putin before he meets with the NATO leaders. But already on Friday, he said that they're not spending enough. And they're concerned that he's going to do something unilateral and at the very least behave in the kind of boorish and disruptive way that he behaved at the G7 in Canada. What are you hearing from your connections in the Pentagon?
Well, there is concern in the Pentagon that Mr. Trump will make a mistake at the NATO summit. There's also a sense that he doesn't really understand what NATO is. The kind of notional description of NATO is as an organization that was formed to push back against the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Now that the Cold War is over, what does it really do? But that's only a partial explanation. I mean, one of the principles of American grand strategy, and there is such a thing, is that there would be that at the end of the 20th century, there was kind of at the end of World War II, rather, there was kind of a recognition that this continuing war in Europe, and there were two in the 20th century, cost 70 million lives, that this just couldn't happen again. And that there had to be collective security in order to keep the countries of Europe kind of in line. So it wasn't just to keep the Soviet Union out of Western Europe. It was to keep the U.S. in and to keep the Germans down, as they said, and to keep France and Germany from repeating the mistakes that they'd repeated for 500 years of going to war with each other and settling nothing except piling up corpses. So NATO served and continues to serve that purpose of kind of keeping stability in Europe, a Europe that had cost a lot of American lives and that the military and the political establishment in Washington determined couldn't happen again. That principle hasn't really changed. It is true the Soviet Union is gone, but there's a good reason why NATO is still there. And the reason that NATO is still there is the United States cannot afford to fight any more wars in Europe, which would be completely destructive. And even if there's a nominal presence, 50,000 American troops, that's enough to keep Europe together and to keep them from fighting. And I don't, you know, I think there's a recognition of this in the Pentagon that NATO serves a very good purpose because it keeps America from shedding blood in these ridiculous and incredibly destructive European wars. And that's part of our nation's grand strategy. NATO is admired in the Pentagon, and there's real unease with the coming NATO summit that Trump doesn't recognize the overall purpose that it really serves.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Perry, who's an author and historian specializing in military, foreign affairs, and intelligence analysis. His books include Conceived in Liberty, A Fire in Zion, and most recently Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. And he has an article at Foreign Policy, Mattis's Last Stand is Iran. So let's talk about the possibility of some of these hawks that have now dominating U.S. foreign policy as we rely on the last adult in the room, James Mattis, who's in many ways no longer in the room, to save us from another blunder like George W. Bush's and Dick Cheney's, Rumsfeld and Rice's war on Iran, on Iraq. So my understanding is that there was in your article, in fact, you pointed out, Mark, that there was a December 2017 RAND Corporation report that a major conflict with Iran would require the U.S. to deploy 21 Air Force fighter squadrons, 5 heavy bomber squadrons, 6 Marine Corps fighter squadrons, 18 attack submarines, 4 aircraft carriers, and a whole bunch of intelligence, surveillance, and et cetera, 6 Marine battalions, 3 Army brigades, and a lot of special forces, not to mention drones, satellites, cruisers, countermine vessels, supply ships, refueling aircraft, and surface-to-air batteries. And the long and the short of it is, of what your sources inside the Pentagon are saying, is that an attack on Iran would not mark the end of a war, but the beginning of a war. So is that the assumption, that they could quickly destroy Iran's military assets, but that would only be the beginning?
Yes, they by quickly, as I noted in the article, or maybe I didn't note in the article, but by quickly, the Pentagon means a 90 days. A 90-day air campaign targeting the Iranian military and nuclear infrastructure, their surface-to-air missiles, their air force, which is not very good, all of their naval assets. A 90-day air campaign, at the end of which Iran's military would be significantly degraded, and whatever was left of their nuclear program would be destroyed. But Iran would not be defeated. I quote in the article Lieutenant General James Dubik. I have very high regard for his thinking as a very well-respected military thinker. And he was very blunt in my interview with him. And he said, listen, Iran's not going to surrender. And when our campaign is over, their campaign will only be beginning. And it could go on and on and on and on. So this idea that somehow Iran is going to be a repeat of Iraq, which was bad enough, lasted years, is wrong. It would last even longer. And it's not clear, considering the readiness standards of our military at present, it's not clear that we would win in the normal sense of the word, that Iran would raise its arms and say, all right, we give up, we surrender. That's just not going to happen. So the question is, and the question for the military, and the reason there's pushback against the idea of intervention in Iran is, what would be the point of doing it? If we're not going to win, and if Iran actually isn't causing us that many problems at present, and they're not, why are we going to do this? Why is it in our interest to do it? What in the hell is John Bolton talking about? So this general feeling in the Pentagon, I think, means that there has been some, probably very quiet and very private, but some pushback against the idea of regime change in Iran. It's not something that the military, not only is it not something the military wants to do, it's not something the military think they can succeed at.
But clearly, though, both Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel and MBS, the Crown Prince in Saudi Arabia, what they want is the American boys and girls to die fighting Iran at their behest. I mean,
I think that's right, and it's not going to happen. I don't quite understand their motivation. Iran is not anywhere close to getting a nuclear weapon. It's not really any kind of a military threat to Israel. All of this talk about how Iran has a crescent of influence across the Middle East and is on the march is nonsense. The Iraqis are very uncomfortable with a neighbor like Iran. They talk to them openly, and they deal with them and trade with them, but the idea that Iraq is somehow under the thumb of Iran, I think it's greatly exaggerated. They do have forces in Syria, but the Assad family, while they've been a steadfast ally of Iran, has always been uncomfortable with being controlled by Iran. They don't want that. So what is Israel exactly afraid of? And what is Saudi Arabia afraid of? Why pick a fight when it would be in their interest, in Israel's interest, in Saudi Arabia's interest, to build their economy, you know, maintain their vigilance, and let Iran, you know, in the best case scenario, Iran is just going to overextend itself. The march to war has not been fully explained to me, and can't be explained like somebody like John Bolton. Why pick a fight with Iran? What, we don't like them? That's never been a good reason to go to war, and it's not a good reason now.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Mark Perry, just back to the NATO summit and the concern amongst NATO allies that Trump's going to do something unilateral and diminish the U.S. role. He never really robustly supported Article 5, the mutual defense part of the treaty, which was invoked in Afghanistan. NATO fought with the U.S. and still is there in Afghanistan. You know, the most amazing stuff is coming from Trump now vis-a-vis Putin. First of all, he said the other day that he believes Putin's, when Putin said he wasn't meddling in our elections. I mean, Trump believes a guy who lies about the shooting down of the Malaysian airline, lies about the little green men that invaded Crimea, lies about his involvement in a war against Ukraine, lies about chemical weapons being used in Syria, lies about Russian bombing of civilians in Syria. I could go on. I mean, this guy, our president believes this guy over NATO and the G7. The Brits were there to basically get a G7 resolution against Russia because of using a weapon of mass destruction on British soil. And what does Trump do before the G7? He makes this statement out of the blue that Russia should be admitted back into the G7. And now he's having a summit with Putin that nobody but Donald Trump wants. So what's going on? What do the people in the Pentagon say? What do they think's going on? Is this guy a traitor?
People in the Pentagon I talk to are extremely careful when they talk about the President of the United States.
Well, he is their commander-in-chief. They have to do that.
Commander-in-chief. They've taken an oath to support the commander-in-chief. But I think that what we're seeing out of the military is a willingness to express their respectful disagreement when asked bluntly about it. The what I call the kind of the yes but answer that we get from the military when a commander in chief does something that makes them uncomfortable. They go, "Yes, sir, but sir, have you thought about?" Or, "Yes, sir, but sir, our idea is that." And the kind of the yes but answer checks both boxes. It allows the military to maintain its loyalty and its pledge to the commander-in-chief and retain civilian control of the military. But the but in the sentence also shows that the military has deep questions about American strategy and that they would like to be a partner in the decision-making. They often are. Sometimes their advice is ignored. That's certainly been the case in the past, and they carry out their orders. I think when it comes to NATO, you know, there's a real tendency among senior officers to try to explain as carefully and patiently as possible why the military holds that NATO is necessary, why the military believes that we must be careful in our talks with our allies, we mustn't feel that we're betraying them, that there's a larger reason why NATO is a good thing. And I don't know if the patience will pay off. I doubt it. Mr. Trump is not the kind of person, as you pointed out, who listens very carefully. I have not heard any military officer ever question the patriotism of Mr. Trump, nor would they. But I think that there is a real anxiety about the continued war on terrorism, about the possibility of further interventions, and I think that there's kind of an underneath all of this is a real worry about the near future under the Trump presidency.
But there is something going on with Putin. Everybody, I think, that's reasonable sees it, don't they? Has anybody ever said anything about what is this peculiar tie that he has to Putin?
Well, I think if you if we study the history of what the military has said about Russia, there is a real animus and a real worry about what Russia is doing in Europe and the development of their military. I have in the past been critical of this point of view because I don't think the Russian military can compare with ours, and they're not. Their weapons aren't that sound or as good as ours, not nearly. The last thing in the world Russia would do is pick a military fight with us. But what kind of fight are they picking? They're not picking a military fight. They're picking a social media fight and a psychological warfare fight and a social media fight. And they seem to have a willing and guileless or naive president who's capable of believing them. And that, I think, is a real worry.
Well, Mark Perry, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Perry, who's an author and historian specializing in military foreign affairs and intelligence analysis. His books include Conceived in Liberty, A Fire in Zion, and most recently, Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. And he has an article at Foreign Policy, Mattis's Last Stand is Iran. And we're going to take a B-Station break. We'll be back speaking with Laura Carlson, who's in Mexico, where she's with a group of international election monitors visiting polling places in today's crucially important presidential election. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Laura Carlson, who is the director of the Mexico-based Americas Program at the Center for International Policy. In 1986, she received a Fulbright scholarship to study the impact of the Mexican economic crisis on women and has lived in Mexico City since then. She blogs at americas.org and is currently with a group of international election monitors visiting polling places in today's watershed elections in Mexico. Welcome to Background Briefing, Laura Carlson.
Thanks very much.
And Laura, what are you seeing there? First of all, the reports that we've been getting is that the election turnout is enormous, but the election authorities were very slow in opening a lot of polling places, and there's massive lines and backup. Is that what you're seeing?
Absolutely. Here in Ecatepec, which is like a gritty kind of industrial suburb on the northern outskirts of Mexico City, we don't have a report from a single polling place that managed to open on time at 8 o'clock. And that's actually against the law. It's an electoral violation not to open on time because it makes it difficult to accommodate the number of people, especially in this election, who want to vote. So we've seen at the polling places that we visited, we've seen long lines of increasingly disgruntled people. But what we've also seen that's most concerning is a series of irregularities that are not, unfortunately, uncommon in Mexico. They include what are called casas amigas, which is a house. Excuse me, there's some street noise. We're here now. Which is a house near the polling place where people pass by to collect the money that they were promised for selling their vote. And these houses are operating openly near a number of polling places. There's especially reports about the problems here in Ecatepec.
So these Casa Amigas, this would be largely the pre-party, right? They're the ones that have perfected the art of buying votes.
William, that's certainly true in this area. From what people have told us, and of course all these irregularities have been documented and reported by the international and national observers. But from what people have told us, yes, they're responsible, and they're focusing on the legislative races because, as you probably know, López Obrador went into this election. He's the left candidate with a 20 to 30 point lead in the polls. So there may be some sense that the PRI has decided that the president's race is now out of their hands and is desperately trying to hold on to the legislature.
So given the brazen nature of this, I mean, when you go to vote and you collect your money from the PRI party, who presumably you voted their way, What evidence or what? How can they be sure that you voted according to, you know, you took their money, but did you do their bidding?
Yeah, well, one of the ways that we've heard about recently, and we don't know because of course we can't go, we wouldn't go into the polling booth with a voter, is that they're required to take a selfie, voting and then depositing their vote. We also know, and this I've heard several observers say that they saw firsthand, that the PRI representatives that they're allowed to have in the polling places as the vote takes place were working with two different lists. One was a list of the voter registration roster, which everyone had, and the other was a list apparently of their own that they were crossing off. And so that list, if it was presumably, and the past would be an indication that this is what it is, presumably would be a list of people's names who'd already presented their voter credential and promised to sell their vote, and in that way they can at least make sure that the person voted. Then they have some other methods as well, but essentially, you know, they're getting more and more sophisticated in terms of how to control this process. And the sad part of it, too, is that we're talking about places where poverty is so extreme and the lack of a citizen culture after 71 years of one-party rule is a problem as well, so that people people will sell their vote for some money to improve their family's economic condition.
And again, I'm speaking with Laura Carlson, who's the director of the Mexico-based America's Program at the Center for International Policy. In 1986, she received a Fulbright scholarship to study the impact of the Mexican economic crisis on women, has lived in Mexico City since then, and she blogs at americas.org and is currently with a group of international election monitors visiting polling places in today's watershed elections in Mexico. And of course, over that 70-plus year span of the rule of the oxymoronic institutional revolutionary party, the PRI, one of the ways that they got the rural vote, because, you know, the big PRI landowners, the oligarchs in Mexico, get all the best land. They just grab it all. And then the ejidos, the poor people, have to scrape out a living in marginal land, and they desperately need fertilizer to grow their crops. And the PRI would give them fertilizer at the, you know, if they voted for them. So there's a myriad of tricks, like Jim Crow tricks that were developed over the years. But it looks like, as you point out, the lead of AMLO, López Obrador, in the presidential poll is such that they can't even rig that. And I take it that's in part because the populace is just so disgusted with corruption and so furious with the lack of personal security because of the rampant violence.
That's exactly right. We've gotten to a point here in Mexico where the status quo is indefensible. So both parties that have ruled over the last couple of decades, the PRI and the Conservative National Action Party, or PAN, are paying the political price of having gotten to the country to this point, to a point where there have been 200,000 assassinations since the war on drugs was launched at the end in December of 2006. There are some 36,000 disappeared people, and that's only by the official registration. And people feel very insecure in many parts of the country, as well as the fact that real wages have actually gone down, and that under a very strict neoliberal economic model, Mexico has been one of the Latin American countries with the lowest rates of growth, just over 2%, and if you look at it per capita, just around 1%. So under that model that was promising to lift Mexico into the first world, growth has pretty much flatlined and worker salaries have gone down. So people just got to the point where they could no longer scare them by saying, no, don't vote for the left because we don't know what will happen and we could lose some of our gains. They're just not seeing the gains. And they're much less afraid of a new factor in politics than they are of the current situation.
But the PRI party murdered its own presidential candidate, Colosio, in Tijuana. And we're still not sure why, but there were some rumors that he may be, have been too sort of progressive for them. But whatever their reasoning is there a chance that they could murder AMLO? Or what could they do to frustrate his what appears to be inevitable rule, because the presidency is quite powerful in Mexico?
That's true. And as I said, they're desperate to hold on to it and to hold on that power, because with it also comes tremendous economic benefits. All the money that the politicians skim off public resources. This has been one of Andrés Manuel López Obrador's major talking points to end the corruption that's been such a drain on the economy and the vast levels of inequality. So there's a couple of scenarios that we're not discarding. And in fact, even though that margin makes it more difficult to talk about fraud or overturning or stealing an election, and even some of the international financial communities and other conservative sectors have gotten used to the idea of him being president, there's still these scenarios and there's still a risk out there. And we're seeing with the levels of fraud, in fact, it's making us a little bit more worried as the day goes on. The first one would be assassination, which seems to be, fortunately, at least not likely. It's always impossible to judge that particular one because it just happens or it doesn't happen pretty much. I mean, It's not something we can exactly quantify in terms of the probability. But then there's another strange scenario, because under the electoral law, if there's utter chaos on election day, if they have to annul or not open some 20% of the polling places, and there's a number of other criteria, then the elections are annulled, and this is the troublesome part of it, the candidates who ran in the annulled elections are forbidden from running again. So they could completely kick Lopez Obrador out of the race if they did that. But so far, we're not seeing that level of chaos, at least. The reports are just coming in. But it looks like, you know, that's not too likely of a scenario either.
Well, I brought up the violence and assassination angle because of so many unprecedented amount of violence in this election so far in Mexico. I think 40-something have died, been 121 assassination attempts on candidates. That in itself has raises some alarms. And it's not as if it would just be some pre-dinosaur who wants to kill Lopez Obrador or his people that get elected on the PID ticket, but there's also the narcos, the drug lords. They're behind a lot of these assassinations. So it's not as if the guy's safe. He could get it from both sides, from the criminal gangs who have subverted Mexico and from their criminal relationship with the PRI.
Yes, and we have to remember that oftentimes those aren't even two different sides, because of the levels of collusion between the governments, local, state, and federal, and the powerful and very brutal drug cartels. So, yes, it is a possibility, but there's another factor to be taken into account, and that is that Lopez Obrador, because of the way he campaigns and because of what he's putting forth, more equality, more social programs for the poor, has a tremendous amount of support. And his supporters are mostly among the poor, and their loyalty is deep, and their anger, if something like that were to happen, would probably be uncontrollable. And so you'd be taking a very serious risk. It'd obviously be extremely drastic and terrible step for Mexico, but it's also not probably a scenario that most even businessmen like.
Right. Well, Laura, we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us on this very important day in Mexico.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be here and to be able to talk to people about what's going on down here, which will define the future not only of Mexico, but of U.S.-Mexico relations and relations within the hemisphere for many years to come.
And again, I've been speaking with Laura Carlson, who's the director of the Mexico-based Americas Program at the Center for International Policy. She blogs at americas.org and is currently with a group of international election monitors visiting polling places in today's watershed elections in Mexico. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. We'll